This is an ABC podcast.
Ni sambuli vinaka no ia e Māori. And to all those celebrating Samoa Language Week, I say ia manuia le vai asulengangana Samoa. Fatalo fatu to our listeners from Samoa, tuning in on 101.1 FM. Olo ingo o Egi Tupong, and you're tuning into Pacific Beat. Ile pokalame ile aso on the program today. Tonga commemorates Emancipation Day. Yes, the abolishment of serfdom. Also, Perth are about to step onto the NRL scene. But what does this have to do with the newly announced PNG team? And Fiji will be leading the world in fashion sustainability. More on those stories shortly. But as always, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Again, I say whakatai molo ono sa'i. Thank you for your patience. Again, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with Vanuatu, who says it is looking to revoke citizenship granted to a high-profile misogynist influencer after it was revealed he allegedly received a Vanuatu passport around the time of his arrest in Romania on charges including rape and human trafficking. Andrew Tate reportedly purchased a fast-tracked Vanuatu passport through the country's development support program in 2022. Prominent Ni Vanuatu women's leader says a person of Mr. Tate's views represents a danger to the community, and the so-called golden passport scheme needs to be reviewed. Lily Rose Walwell reports.
The Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Project broke the story that Andrew Tate was granted a Vanuatu passport in December 2022, the same month he was arrested in Romania. He was later charged with rape, human trafficking and forming a criminal gang to exploit women. The OCCRP's lead editor for the Pacific, Altri Pelford, says the organization was investigating golden passports in Vanuatu when they came across the name Imori Andrew Tate and then worked to establish it was the same person as the online influencer.
The system has been abused by, you know, oligarchs, organized criminals, intelligence agents, and it's caused a lot of alarm because it is one of these loopholes that allows people to get a new passport or even a new identity and, you know, be able to avoid, you know, their war enforcement.
The Tate revelations are the latest in a string of controversies surrounding the lucrative citizenship by investment scheme that have led to both the European Union and the United Kingdom removing Vanuatu's visa-free travel status. Earlier this year, it was revealed that Vanuatu provided a golden passport to fugitive Indian ex-cricket boss Lalit Moti, who applied to officially renounce his Indian citizenship after acquiring citizenship of the Pacific nation. Vanuatu government spokesperson Kerry Manasa says there have clearly been problems with the country's various citizenship by investment schemes.
It shows a lapse in the due processes that are in place. So definitely the government needs to tighten it. These are loopholes that the people have overlooked in the past.
He says government is investigating how Mr. Tate obtained the passport.
We're definitely looking into it. And once we have the files, definitely the processes will be in place to revoke his citizenship. The government definitely does not want to encourage people of questionable backgrounds to be granted citizenship. Of course, those that are wanted by their countries or are being investigated by police authorities from overseas are not welcome to be part of the citizenship of Vanuatu.
Last month, prosecutors in the UK brought charges of rape, actual bodily harm and human trafficking against both Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan Tate, relating to alleged offences that took place between 2012 and 2015. The brothers, who are both citizens of the US and UK, deny all allegations brought by Romanian and British prosecutors. There was no indication that Tristan Tate, who was also arrested in Romania in 2022, had received Vanuatu citizenship, according to the OCCRP's report. The president of the Port Vila Women's City Council, Jane Nyatika, says there's no way a person with Andrew Tate's well-publicized misogynistic views should have been granted Vanuatu citizenship.
Before Vanuatu goes out to give its passport to the people who apply to for citizenship in Vanuatu, Vanuatu has to fully review its application before it can offer citizenship.
She says those views pose a danger to the community if Mr. Tate were to ever set foot in the country.
Our literature level is low, and understanding what the person is saying, they will find it hard to understand him, and they will fall into these activities very easily.
Vanuatu's Prime Minister Chotam Napat has vowed to reform the troubled but lucrative economic citizenship program since coming to power earlier this year. But spokesman Gerry Manasa says it will take time.
We're working on it, and these are things that will take time, especially to put back the confidence and the credibility of our travelling document.
And that is Vanuatu Government spokesman Gerry Manasa ending that report from Lily Rose Walwell.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cecil Smarcy, thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat. Continuing our coverage from yesterday, carver industry in the Pacific is booming, now valued between $1.5 and $2 billion as demand from Australia and the United States soar. But the region is struggling to find a balance between profiting off the crop often referred to as being a bank and the cultural implications of its widespread popularity. Lucy Cooper reports.
It's a drink sought out by some for its sedative effects. But for others, carver stirs strong emotions.
I was so upset. I cried.
Ruth Cross-Quansing is a government minister in Kiribati who believes carver is threatening her home's way of life and development.
What we're seeing is a really disturbing trend that really does face dire consequences for our population if it's not tackled in a meaningful way.
Kiribati can't grow the carver plant, so supplies are imported. And at $100 a kilo, it doesn't come cheap. In the past year, the Pacific nation spent $28 million importing carver from Vanuatu. And Ruth Cross-Quansing believes locals are using their welfare benefits to pay for the substance.
The government working so hard to lift people out of poverty and all of its, you know, all of its negative impacts, only to realise that it's being invested into carver, which is, again, just totally drags us right back down.
While carver consumption is relatively new in Kiribati, for other Pacific countries like Fiji, it's long been a part of life. It's often presented as a gift or used ceremoniously, and it's valued for its anti-anxiety properties.
Carver has been for many years, centuries, been seen as part of what we do to create community. It does provide that sense of ability to feel like you're part of something bigger.
Chiochi Ravulo is Professor and Chair of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney and an Adjunct Professor at the University of the South Pacific. He's concerned its growing popularity is also bringing increased abuse.
So technically it is a substance that could be classed as a drug, just like alcohol and other drugs. And so with any substance, you can become addicted and or dependent on.
Demand for the drink is also soaring outside the Pacific region, providing much needed export dollars for local economies. Since commercial imports of carver to Australia resumed in 2021, Coles supermarkets have begun stocking carver products on their shelves. This month, Woolworths plans to follow suit. Chairman of the Tongan National Carver Committee, Vologitao Kaho Tevi, says the global carver market is projected to reach $1.5 to $2 billion this year, fuelled by Australian supermarkets and the emergence of so-called carver bars in the US.
We have carver bars running into the hundreds with double-digit percentage growth over the last 5 to 6 years. Yeah? The carver plant is considered like a bank. That's how the farmers keep money. If they want something, if they want to pay a school fee or pay for the children to go and study, they will go and uproot 1, 2, 3, 4 plants.
But for a crop that takes years to grow, climate change is limiting expansion. And with some estimates suggesting the global carver market could be worth $8.7 billion by 2033, there are calls for carver-growing Pacific nations to work together to meet demand.
This is an opportunity for countries in the future on an annual basis to really feature how they and what role the carver plant plays in their society and in their economy.
Professor Ravulo believes that this could be a boon for small farmers, provided the potential risks of the product are well understood.
If we take a harm minimisation approach where we're educating people to understand any possible harms associated with significant usage of any substance, including carver, then that's key to ensuring that people are making informed decisions around any substance use.
And that's Professor Giorgio Ravulo from the University of Sydney, ending that report by Lucy Cooper. Well, a ban on the sale of machetes was announced here in the Australian state of Victoria in May, following a spate of high-profile criminal attacks. Seven people were injured during one incident at a Melbourne shopping mall on a Sunday afternoon. But the ban on machetes has had a disproportional effect on the Pacific Islands community, who rely on certain machete knives for cultural and personal use. Bolotai Vau Te Omaiava Amiai Malo is president of the United Pasifika Council of Victoria Incorporated, and he joins us this morning. Afio Mailo, Afionga Bolotai Vau, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Talo Falava. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it. Look, I know from September, Victorians are asked to basically hand in all their machete knives or face up to, looks like, $47,000 in fines or even 2 years jail time. I mean, what's this all going to mean for our Pacific Island community?
It's a great concern for the Pacific Island communities. I can speak specifically for the Samoan community. We have certain items that are categorized as machetes, important items, cultural items, such as the nifoti, which is a traditional Samoan knife that's been used as cultural significance items for special occasions, for cultural dances, events, special events, for birthdays, weddings, items like that, heirlooms. These are important items culturally for Samoans. I think, you know, it's going to be a very difficult process, not only to comprehend, but to hand over these important items. So it's of great concern. Not only that, but how does, you know, a community who practice, you know, safekeeping and respect for these items, and to be affected because of someone from another community or background has done the wrong thing and has affected us greatly for this. So it's a great concern. I don't know how our community will hand over these items. It's highly unlikely they would, because you know it holds a very special place in our culture and for families.
Well, and this is it, Bolotai Vau. You know, you talk about you know, a group and their actions have now, you know, affected other communities. And I want to go to the fact that, you know, there is a crime problem in Victoria where machetes are being used in attacks. And I think we should acknowledge that issue. But you don't think a ban is the best way, right, of dealing with this problem? I mean, how do you think it could be better handled rather than through a ban?
I think there's, you know, there's opportunities for more education, more funding in, you know, services, youth services that deal with crime prevention programs for young people, educating them. We don't hear any Pacific Islanders using machetes. You know, these items are, you know, sacred to us. We don't abuse them. In our community, for some low-income earning families who can't afford lawnmowers and paying landscapers to come and, you know, clean their gardens, that, you know, The machete is a very, you know, important tool for doing gardening. They use it in the islands, and they continue using it here. It's a cheap way to maintain the garden. Also, with our cooking, cutting up, meat, fish, pork, so it's used in, daily, practices for special occasions, festive seasons and things like that. Again, I can't totally agree on, banning machetes. Again, you've got one particular age group have misused it, and it affects other people. We're talking about youth here. And then, the ban is on, people that are of mature age, adults, that are not using, misusing these things. So maybe it's something that could be, something of an age limit, to be used. We've applied for an exemption. Because other communities, religious groups that carry around, certain lives because they're, religious items. For us, it's we want the same. So we're still waiting for a reply, from the government. And we're very surprised with, this, short notice in terms of taking it off the shelves. So, busy with the...
How did that affect our Pacifica businesses or retailers here in Melbourne, knowing that it was quite a swift, shutdown on the sale of machetes?
I think the communication, I don't know if the government or, the respective, government departments have communicated this well to our community. The community groups or the shops, the shop owners from the Pacific Island communities weren't aware of it. So I had to call them specifically and say, are you aware of this? Can you take off these cultural items that are categorized as machetes? Even though, our cultural items, they are blunt, they're not sharpened. They're just, a blunt type of knife that are only used for ceremonies and dances and for photo, opportunities for events.
Do you think that
they were surprised? They were upset. They said, if we take it off our shelves, who's going to pay for this? How are we going to get our money back from it? Some of these items, cost up to $240, $50 each. So it's their income. It's their way of, so they're still waiting in the dark, to be told whether they're going to get compensated for these items. And I said, look, for the moment, just take it off the shelf and we'll wait for the next directive.
Yeah. I would love to know, Polizaval, by September, people will have to, get exemptions, as you say, you have already applied, to own machetes. Do you think that our Pacific community members will actually go out of their way to actually get those exemptions? And the reason I only ask that is because what happens several years down the line if they get pulled up for owning machetes without an exemption? I mean, again, they could possibly face jail time. Do you think they're going to take this seriously?
I think this is the responsibility for the community leaders to, make a stand for our people at this time and wait for, whatever the response of the government, our local state. If the response is, there is no exemption, I guess we're going to have to accept that and find a way to bring the community together in a consultation or a forum, a space where the government could come and, speak to the community and say these are the reasons, even though, our people are not a people just of, talking on the phone or on a Zoom or online, but we're people of face-to-face. So I do I will expect that the government will come and speak to our communities face to face in this decision. And we're just going to have to follow the law of the land. It's going to hurt us, but, you know, it's something that, you know, we have to accept.
Yeah, definitely a personal thing, of course, for our Pacific community, especially our Samoan communities, knowing that they use Ngāti Whaoti all the time, you know, with our cultural and personal use. Sorry, that is all the time that we have for this morning. I know this discussion will continue, but it's just I really appreciate Whaftai Tere Lava for being on our show this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity, Whaftai Lava.
No worries. That, of course, is Politau Vau Te Omaiawa Amiai Malo, President of the United Pacifica Council of Victoria Incorporated.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Papua New Guinea. They were the talk of the rugby league world when it was announced a club based out of Port Moresby would join the NRL in 2028. But in recent weeks, however, the focus has shifted to another newcomer, the Perth Bears, who would join the NRL a year before PNG in 2027. Unlike PNG, the Bears are close to a finished product. They have long-standing brand forged in North Sydney, an established talent pathway and strong commercial backing. Now, one researcher is wondering if the Bears are an insurance policy for the NRL in case a PNG struggles to get up and running. Hugh Piper is a director at Ancrum Advisory, a strategic advisory services firm in public policy. He's also the editor of The Policymaker, and he joins us on the line now. With that, I say welcome, Hugh, to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. I know that you've penned an article for the Lowy Institute on this subject. Why do you get the impression that Perth is somehow some insurance for PNG's NRL team?
Yeah, so looking at this from the NRL's perspective, everything is really about getting to an even number of teams. So, you know, right now that means getting up to 18 from 17 teams since the Dolphins joined in 2023. And what 18 teams means is that there'll be 9 games in most rounds up from the current 8, and that would put the NRL on par with the AFL, its main competition. And, you know, one more game a week essentially means that there's 2 or 3 extra hours of TV content that the NRL can put on the table when it looks to negotiate the TV rights deal, the next deal that starts in 2028. But really, I guess where that 18th team is, whether it's one based in Perth or whether it's one based in Port Moresby, well, for the NRL, that's almost a secondary consideration. And, you know, given that there are already doubts about whether the PNG team will be available and actually able to enter the competition in 2028, one way of looking at, you know, the I guess rush to get Perth in the competition by 2027 is that it's a way that it allows the NRL to guarantee to broadcasters that there will definitely be 9 games in each round from 2028 onwards. You know, there's not a 20th team happening anytime soon, so, you know, it'd be great to see PNG become that 19th team, but that's not, it's important, but it's definitely not essential.
But Hugh, can I ask what factors makes it easier to establish an NRL club in Perth, I suppose, as opposed to PNG then?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. I think, you know, one of the sort of unfortunate and I guess unintended effects of the Perth Bears announcement has been that, you know, in talking up the benefits of Perth, the NRL has also, I guess, highlighted some of the unanswered questions about a PNG club as well. So I guess if you think through the franchises themselves, as you said in the introduction, the Bears already have a kind of an existing brand, a supporter base that covers both Sydney and Perth. You know, we're yet to see, I guess, the PNG club develop a kind of identity, a brand. You know, will it be based off the Hunters, the existing team that plays in the Queensland Cup, or will it be something different? If you think about the club infrastructure, you know, North Sydney has a like commercially successful leagues club. There's already support for the Bears plus a kind of talent pathway for juniors. Although there's a big talent base in PNG of juniors, there's no kind of equivalent system. And then if you start to think about like player interest, you know, there's many players and coaches that have already been linked to Perth. It's a much more and there's a much more modest level of player interest so far for PNG. And that's before you start to think about, I guess, you know, the places, thinking about Perth versus Port Moresby. You know, WA has a GDP per capita about 25 times larger than PNG. There's a really strong existing professional sports infrastructure in Perth, and then that plays into the commercial opportunities. And as well, you know, Perth, it's a highly developed and safe city. Whereas in Port Moresby, you know, there's already been commitments to spend $150 million in addition to the $600 million that's been put on the table for the team, just to build a village for the players, coaches and staff to keep them safe. So there's a really strong contrast between the two places, which also makes it, you know, unfortunately a difficult comparison.
Right. Well, Hugh, I know you pointed out that, you know, government financial support is something both PNG and Perth have in common. However, in PNG's case, it serves, you know, a geopolitical purpose. Why could that be a problem maybe long term?
Yeah, so the thing about geopolitics and foreign policy is that it can change and often rapidly so. So you've got a lot of variables at play here. You know, the political leadership in both Australia and PNG, that can change, whether that be through elections or other means. You know, there's budgetary pressures broadly in Australia on the budget, but even if you drill down, I guess, on the international policy budget, you know, defence expenditure growth is under pressure to increase. And, you know, that money's got to come from somewhere, and this could be a source of it. There's already been queries raised, including by Anthony Galloway from Capital Brief, from an FOI request about how the Commonwealth money is being used as part of this grant of $600 million. Of course, PNG has its own budgetary pressures, given its commitment to spend $150 million of its own money. And then I guess you've got this question of the parallel security agreement that underlies the agreement that the NRL holds, and that's between the Australian government and PNG, that essentially allows the Australian government to withdraw its funding and support if Papua New Guinea enters a security agreement with another power. And I guess the unnamed but obvious power here is China. And so if there's, you know, a shifting balance of power in the Indo-Pacific, including with the lower commitment that we're already seeing from the United States, the foreign policy calculus of PNG and Port Moresby could also shift, and that then puts the team in jeopardy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What I'm hearing is it sounds like the main priority, though, for the NRL is to get that magic even number right of teams to maximise that TV deal. So then you think Perth is the safer option in the short term? Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say, definitely in the short term. You've got, you know, that established infrastructure, there's players who are super interested in going there. And it's much more viable, I think, to get it up off the ground by 2027 ahead of that next rights deal. And what that does do is give the NRL, I guess, a cushion that means that, you know, if it needs to, the PNG team can be pushed back by 1 or 2 or maybe even 3 years to make sure they get it right and up off the ground before it's introduced.
Well, then let's look at the flip side, though, Hugh, because, you know, Perth has had an NRL franchise in the past that didn't actually succeed. You know, and NRL is also not the preferred code out west. Do you think it's possible that PNG could turn out to be more successful than Perth long term?
So I think, you know, the lesson here is that professional sports franchises in Australia definitely have a mixed record of business success and long-term viability. You know, there's just as many top flight rugby league sides that used to be in the competition as there are current ones. And one of those is, as you say, the Western Reds, you know, a team that was briefly in the competition in the 90s. Mm. You know, there are big plus factors for the PNG team, especially in comparison to Perth. Like, obviously, as you said, like local interest is one of those. Rugby league is entering a really crowded market, especially in the winter code over in Perth. Whereas rugby league is obviously like the national sport of PNG, and in fact, it's the only country that has rugby league as its national sport. You know, there's a huge amount of local talent, huge amount of passion in PNG about rugby league that probably doesn't exist to the same degree in Perth. And, you know, as well, the Papua New Guinea government is offering tax breaks to Australian players if they'll play in PNG, and that's not something that the Western Australian government is putting on the table for players in Perth. You know, there's definitely, I think, more growth potential in PNG than in Perth. You know, it's a big, wide open market that the NRL can capture in Papua New Guinea, whereas, you know, there's certainly a scenario in which the Perth team kind of caps out at a lower level, whereas the PNG team, once it kind of is established and gets momentum, that could, you know, grow almost exponentially, and there's kind of no cap on where that could go.
Hugh, look, as we wrap up, based on all your research, though, would you at least bet on the PNG club standing the test of time?
Look, I'm not a betting man, but I think like all rugby league fans, I really want it to succeed. I think now that the expectation has been created in Australia and with the people of Papua New Guinea that there will be a team and it will happen, I think what that means is that for both the Australian government and the PNG government and I guess the commercial partners and the NRL, everyone's kind of staked too much, frankly, to let it fail at this point. I think the real question is when it will happen and how much it will cost. But, you know, the risk then becomes that, you know, sunk cost fallacy in if the costs do continue to grow, how much do you continue to invest because of those existing commitments? And at what point might either the Australian government or the PNG or the NRL say enough is enough, this is getting too hard and costing us too much?
Yeah, as you said earlier, budget pressures, right? Hugh, look, that's all the time we have for this morning. Some great insight into the situation. But again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That is Hugh Piper, Director at Ancrum Advisory and Editor of The Policymaker. Time to head to a bit of a break.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
We head to Fiji now. Once dismissed as a novelty, the Pacific fashion scene now demands to be seen and taken seriously. Not only is it raising the profile of the region's designers and stories, it also has the potential to lead the fashion world in sustainability. Letha Mavono reports from Fiji Fashion Week.
Fiji Fashion Week has turned 18, and with it, Pacific fashion is entering adulthood. At the center of this transformation is Managing Director Ellen Whippy Knight. Since 2009, she's fought to build a platform where talent meets business.
That fashion is not just a novelty. The dresses don't just drop out of the sky. These are all choreographed, pre-planned, very organized, involves supply chains, and that is the technicality of the industry. And the fact now people understand that fashion is actually a business.
With over 30 designers now owning shops or selling online, Fiji's fashion industry is experiencing significant growth. But its power lies in something deeper: storytelling through garments. For Sugar Rose designer and 2025 judge Atilaiten Downimbao, that story is personal.
We weren't as celebrated before, but now everyone wants a piece of a local designer. And that's, I don't know, I feel so proud.
The runway is alive with cultural references, woven mats, Vanua-inspired silhouettes, Masi prints, and island life told through textiles. And it has drawn praise from international fashion voices. Patty Huttington, features and fashion news director at Harper's Bazaar Australia and Australian fashion correspondent for the South China Morning Post, said this was her fourth fashion week.
Incredible colour, incredible prints. And it's one country where the menswear is as strong as the womenswear. And the menswear that we see on the runways here, I mean, it's just so vibrant and colourful. And of course, Fijian men wear lots of colours and prints. And I mean, that would just soar on the international market.
While Fijian designers are pushing aesthetic boundaries, they face real obstacles. No formal fashion school, high import costs, and limited manufacturing. Whippy Knight says technical fashion training is the next frontier.
We must have technical fashion education. You know, it's a professional job. The clothes must be factory finished. You can't have zips that don't sit properly. You can't have hook and eye that are crooked. You can't have seams that are still got raw edges. You can't have roping on the hems and machine hems. All those things need a particular type of machine equipment to make them look presentable, because, you know, a bad hem just affects the whole sale.
Despite those gaps, sustainability and story are driving design excellence. Designer Hupful Herder, who is about to complete his doctoral studies on Pacific fashion at Western Sydney University, says Pacific fashion is uniquely positioned to lead with conscience.
And I'm looking forward to come back and do some training, not just inspire designers, but there's a purpose. Give them a purpose to be conscious of, like, my passion is not only just fashion, but, you know, you have to think of the environment and the longevity, the long term of garments and what what we're producing and how we can manage that in terms of pollution. Everything has to do with climate change, but I think that's also very important, just to make sure that designers are conscious of that, what they produce. So being a bespoke designer that makes exclusive garments, I think that for me, it's easier for me to manage rather than the mass produce, because I think there's a story behind each collection, each garment, and you want people to have that personal touch to it.
The connection to place and people is also at the heart of Cherish Prasad's work. Born in Savu Savu, he uses fashion to promote his community.
I'm so proud of where I come from, because I would say from all the other places I've been to, Savu Savu has a tight-knit community. We're always there for each other. Like, take for me example. I've been to international shows, and I need funding for that. And I'm so grateful that Savu Savu is always backing me up. Any fundraising like this, they're all there, full support. Whether it's a cover barrel or a raffle, they're out there buying tickets, supporting me. That's why I always try and put Savu Savu on the map.
From bespoke creations to bold cultural prints, Fiji's designers are rewriting the rules, proving that fashion here isn't just an industry.
We are so ready for the international market, and we are just getting better and better.
That there is the sounds of Fiji Fashion Week and its managing director, Alan Whippy Knight. That report from Lethe Mavono and Suva. Morena, welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time to head around the region, get the latest headlines with our producer, Carl Evans. How are you doing, sir?
I'm well, Aggie. Yeah, no, it's Wednesday already, if you can believe it. I am struggling with these mornings, though.
But thank you. Thank you for coming through. Yes, on Hump Day here on News Wrap, let's start in Vanuatu. They've actually lashed out at Australia for expanding a major gas project.
Yeah, that's right. So Vanuatu's climate minister, Ralph Reginvanu, is not happy with Australia's decision to extend a major natural gas project while at the same time making a bid for COP31. So that's according to The Guardian. And the project he's referring to is the Woodside Gas Project and the extension of one of the world's biggest gas facilities until 2070. So it's Australia's third highest emitting facility. It produces about 6 million tonnes of greenhouse gases each year. And Reginvanu has essentially accused of Australia of mixed messaging, saying their actions contradict what they say about climate change.
Well, I have to ask, has Australia actually made any comment to the backlash?
Not directly to Ralph, but I guess the selling point of this extension in the first place was that it was needed in Western Australia to help help renewables backed by gas. However, the facility would have closed in 2030 without that extension. So, yeah, 40 years is a long time to extend something. You know, it's certainly not a short term thing. And some experts say it could actually set Australia's climate goals back by another 10 years. Meanwhile, the United Nations is expected to announce which country will host COP in the coming weeks, and the government have their sights firmly set on an Adelaide based event. It looks like.
All right. Let's head to teens who attacked Dolte Geffel and his family in Brisbane in a home invasion. They've had their sentences upheld. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So Queensland's Attorney General has lost an appeal against the sentences handed to two teenagers who attacked Geffel and his family way back in 2021. It was a wild story at the time. I remember reading about it. The government had launched an appeal on the grounds that basically the punishment they received didn't fit the crime. So the two boys were given less than 10 years in detention and had no convictions recorded against them, something that the government deemed pretty light, given what they called a pretty heinous crime. However, the Court of Appeal found no error had been made with the sentence and rejected the Attorney General's argument. The teenagers had rejected the Attorney General's argument that the teenagers should have had convictions recorded.
Right.
And it's worth pointing out as well that the two boys were 15 at the time of the offence and had no criminal history.
Carla, I do have to ask though, do you know if there's been any statement from Dolte Geffel himself though about this whole
situation? Not in the article I read, no.
Okay, no worries. Lastly though, Palau's president, Sarangal Whips Jr., wants to see Taiwan at the Pacific Islands Forum. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is right. He does want to see Taiwan given full access at this year's meeting in the Solomon Islands. He made the comments in the wake of his recent trip to Taiwan, saying he's heard there's been some difficulties so far with Taiwan gaining access. As we know, the forum is being held in Solomon Islands, who have pledged support to China's One China policy very, very recently as well. And Mr. Whips just wants to make sure that everyone in the entire PIF team is doing all it can to ensure that everyone who's entitled to be there is be there. And that includes, he includes Taiwan among that group, given they still share diplomatic ties with three forum members, Palau being one of them.
And I have to ask, has Solomon Islands had anything to say about this?
Only that the government is not in a position to comment on participation or related arrangements for the PIF Leaders Summit as of yet, and the registration process has not opened. So, yeah, no potential for awkwardness with that one.
Of course. Look, that is your headlines from across the region, brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, here on Pacific Beat. Wow, today marks 163 years since Tonga's King Siausitubo I abolished serfdom. Under his 1862 code of laws, commoners were no longer controlled and bound to serve chiefs. It's a move that was well respected by his people, where the king also introduced Christianity, established the country's first constitution, and founded its parliament. But to give us a better understanding of what this day actually means, we're joined by the Dean of Faculty at Te Nisi University in Tonga, Vasuloa Jenna Helo, who is also currently doing a research of linguistics, philology and phonetics at the Oxford University. And so she joins us from the UK. Maloita mai pongpongini, Vasaloa, welcome to the show.
Maloita lava ki e fafini.
Thank you. Yes, that's right. Thank you so much for your time. I have to say, happy Emancipation Day. But, you know, how important or significant is this day for the people of Tonga?
It's a significant day, especially as it is the abolition of the alleged chiefly control over individuals. And I guess emancipation in Tonga might mean differently to some people because you associate it with slavery and serfdoms. So when you think of our history, we need to look back at Tonga's history. That's when this 1862 Emancipation Day by King George I came in. But when we think of the chiefly system and commoners in the ancient time, that's the Tuitonga, right? That's different to what we have. So when you have serfdom, you're looking at the structure of king, nobles, and serfdoms.
Mm.
So we need to define that clearly in what we mean by emancipation in Tonga, because it has come through with slave trades that's been going on in Europe and the serfdoms in Europe.
Mm.
And then they have to set them free. So it's a liberation of these people.
Yeah.
And we need to talk about Tonga before the Christianity arrived. There's talk of slavery to the chiefs. Well, the history has been written by missionaries. So we need to also be careful with what we talk about when we say emancipation in Tonga, whether we're talking about serfdom or whether we're talking about slave trade, slavery, blackbirding that took place in the Pacific.
Mm.
But it is a day of celebration, so I guess the 4th of June has been set aside since 1862.
So I believe, you know, the king was revered, you know, for making such a radical move in abolishing serfdom. But Vasaloa, if he didn't, what do you think Tonga's society would have looked like?
We need to look at our... We have a monarchy set up in the 19th century. There was no monarchy before that. So when you have serfdoms, you're looking at a structure of a monarchy, the nobles, and then the serfdoms. And the serfdoms are the serfs that work the land owned by the lord of that land. We didn't have that. So when we look at the Tuitonga structure, political structure, that's where it's vague, because we don't know enough about it, about the ruling in the ancient time between 950 AD and the 19th century, when we became a monarchy. So that's where I think we need to defined our own emancipation in Tonga. Yeah. What are we talking about? Are we talking about that the Tui Tonga in the chiefly system actually enslaved the people? So, you know, I think that's where I'm coming in.
Yeah.
I'm coming in from the perspective of looking at it rather than looking at what, like, even in the United States when they abolished the slave trade and slavery.
Mm.
Did we have that in Tonga before the monarchy in the 19th century?
And that leads me to that leads me to that whole thing about, you know, colonial powers pretty much dominated the region in that time. But do you believe the choices that the king made actually led to Tonga never being colonized?
I don't think we can say Tonga has never been colonized, because we have been colonized via the Christian missionaries.
Right.
The missionaries that actually set up the monarchy system are the Wesleyan Methodist Missionary Society. When they arrived in Australia, and then they went out from there and started in Tonga, missionizing the island. So the missionaries went around and converted. And they are the ones that write the history. So when we look at the history, it can be biased. So we need to be clearly identifying what was it like before they arrived in Tonga, before the Christianizing of Tonga. And then now we have a monarchy with nobles, and we don't have serfdoms. But if we talk about serfdoms that used to be in European countries, used to be in Britain, they actually set these serfs free. Instead of working the land that's owned by the landlords and the nobles, they set them free. That's where emancipation came in. But, of course, emancipation means liberation or liberating, freedom. So if we look at how our history has been written, it might be that the missionaries wrote it to favor what they've done in the Pacific. And if we say that we've never been colonized, we have been colonized in the sense that our political structure has changed drastically by the missionaries. And now we have a monarchy and the nobles. And we still have, we pay at least to the nobles and the land in Tonga. Now, when you look at the chiefly system that was before the 19th century, we're talking about a system where the kauhala uta, kauhala lalo, and we rely on the ha'a system and the chiefs, sub-chiefs, to actually share and do this polo polo and all these traditions. They've been wiped out when the missionaries came to the Pacific. So we need to actually look at our own emancipation. What is it? What are we trying to do here? Do we need to make it emancipation of the serfdoms, because we didn't have that? We don't have that now. So how are we going to actually define that without the nobles? And we can't, because we have nobles now. So the missionaries have been doing that in favor of what they've done by actually converting most of the Pacific Islands into Christianity, depending, of course, on which denomination.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Whether it's the Protestants, British Protestants, or the French Catholics.
Vassalor, we only literally have about a minute left with your time, and we do appreciate it. But is this just something that, how does this make Tonga unique from other Pacific nations?
Unique in the sense that we claim that we're different, but we're not, because we have been having chiefly system all the time. And the difference is that now we have a monarchy since the 19th century, but the other islands don't have that. So if we say that that's our uniqueness, then it depends on which side you're looking at, yeah. at our what we define ourselves as.
Of course.
But I think there needs to be a clearer, more clear history if we look back before we get a monarchical system in Tonga, 19th century.
You have given us some great insight into, of course, what the Emancipation Day means for our people back home in the homeland and, of course, across the diaspora too. But, Vassalor, that is all the time we have left for today. I do really appreciate you joining us, of course, at night time there in the UK. Malo apita hosi ikau mai ke pokarama.
Malo. Okay. No fua.
That is Dean of Faculty at Atenisi University in Tonga, Vassalor Jenna Hello, joining us from the UK here on Pacific Beat. Well, that is the end of Pacific Beat. You can join us again at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow. Tune in this afternoon, though, at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next is your news on ABC Radio Australia, followed by the dynamic duo, Jacob Acquire and Michael Chow on Nisha Daily. Until next time, I say Manuia Lawaso. Have a great day. Whaftai te re lava. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.